welcome to Pints with Treebeard. My name is Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho. And today I have the joy, the delight, privilege of being joined by Mr. Jameson Winter, a leader of men, captain of industry. Jameson, what would you like the fine folks to know about you?
Yes, I'm Jameson Winter, and I'm the dean of the upper school here at Augustine School in Jackson, Tennessee. So, Josh, what are we talking about today?
So, in light of the upcoming holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, New Year's, Advent, Epiphany, whatever you want to add to those, I was reflecting on it. We call them just like the holidays because those are the only ones that we really celebrate as a culture, or maybe they're just the biggest ones. It's just interesting. Like, when you say the holidays, everyone knows you mean end of November, December. Like, that's everyone knows that, which is just interesting. We'll come to that later. But as we're approaching, time of the year for us, Thanksgiving is what, a week and a half away, 10 days, and then you know Christmas obviously follows in the heels. I thought it'd be good to just kind of think, as we are wont to do, think big picture about the nature of feast and festivity, but then also try to get practical and think about what is the dad's role in festivity? What is the dad's role in particularly? The feasts of Thanksgiving and Christmas. We are hoping to dive more into Christmas specifically in some later episodes. I can't have too much Christmas. So this will be broader and with maybe a more of a Thanksgiving tinge to it. So that's the plan. That's the goal.
And to that point, the reason we're releasing this on the 24th rather than at the end of this week is because we'd miss the whole Thanksgiving window if we released the Friday after Thanksgiving. So hopefully this can be something that can fuel some celebration and holiday thought ahead of a major holiday in the year. And maybe won't radically change what you're doing, but hopefully give you some encouragement and some reasoning and biblical backing behind what we do when we celebrate Thanksgiving, Advent, even New Year's, not a Christian holiday, so to speak, but it's tied right there in the midst of it. How do we celebrate well as Christians? And that's what we want to think about today.
That's right. So trying to trace it back or boil it down or get at the essence of the thing, to celebrate, to participate in festivity, what is going on here? And as I've been chewing on it, it has to do with making something sacred. And actually, I think this ties directly into our the episode we did on dating, on dates, rather. We talked about dates as being for celebration, as being set apart, as a sacred thing in a sense. And in that sense, to go on a date with your wife is a subset of festivity. It is a celebration. But festivity is that, always. It's setting time aside. Like we talked about last time with the around the dinner table, we are in the business of creating spaces, creating places, rather, turning spaces into places, doing that not only in space, but also in time. So we set aside times to remember, to enjoy, to give thanks, to celebrate, to be generous. And this all ties back, it goes all the way back to Genesis 1. It goes all the way back to the creation account where God sets the pattern for us in the seventh day rest. So I would argue festivity flows from Sabbath rest, which is what we see God doing, right? And he makes us in his image, so we are to be like him in that sense. So God creates in 6 days, and the seventh day is holy. The seventh day is separate, right? And then he invites us, commands us, requires us to do likewise. So when we are celebrating, we are actually taking from that or participating in that Sabbath rest that was at the beginning and will be to all eternity. Famously, when you're reading through Genesis 1, there's no evening and morning the seventh day. Right? There's evening and morning all the other days, but the seventh day never ends. Right? Why is that? It's because the seventh day goes on forever. It's the rest that we are all looking forward to. So when God invites his people to remember the Sabbath, to keep it holy, This is an invitation to participate now in the Sabbath rest that is to come. And that's the same thing that we're doing when we gather around the Thanksgiving table, the same thing we do when we gather for Christmas. It's the same basic thing.
And one of the beautiful things about the idea of Sabbath rest, as you've illustrated it and as we see it illustrated in the scriptures, is that God is teaching us through this how to enjoy Him and how to enjoy His good gifts in creation, how to walk faithfully in that enjoyment and use it as a means of worship and delight in Him and in one another in an appropriate way, rather than in some kind of selfish way or self-centered way that seeks to make much of the desires of the flesh or the pleasures of this world. And so I think sometimes as Christians, we can be tempted, I know that we can be tempted not to celebrate well because it's delighting in the things that God has given us here and in the momentary day-to-day pleasures like apple pie and smoked turkey and these sorts of things. And we can be overly cautious about that sort of indulgence because we don't want it to be an indulgence in the sense that it's wrong. But I think we've got that just reverse. It's not that we need to hold those things at a distance, although there's need for wisdom. You know, you don't need to take out a second mortgage on your house to throw a party and celebrate the advent of the Lord. That's walking outside of wisdom. But within your means, you do want to celebrate things that are worth celebrating somewhat lavishly. And to do that poorly, to do that in a frugal way, maybe an overly frugal way, right? A penny-pinching kind of way, is in some ways to lie about what God has given us in the good gift, not only of these things, but of Himself. And it's also, I think, to live in fear that we won't be taken care of, that He won't provide for us. So I've alluded to that before, right? Treating your wife and kids to ice cream or something like that when it wasn't necessarily in the plan. There are occasions for that sort of celebration or a delightful treat, recognizing we're celebrating something good and right here. Like there's an occasion for this. And so holidays are a great place, I think, to practice that and to trust the Lord. You know, you can talk to any married couple who struggled financially early on in marriage, which is most of us, right? Most of us have been in that kind of paycheck to paycheck world at some point early on in marriage. And we'll tell you, and they'll tell you, yeah, Christmas was slim sometimes, but that doesn't mean that we didn't celebrate. That doesn't mean that we didn't spend more than we would have on Christmas dinner or the presents that we were giving or things like that. You just might not have had that much more to spend, but you did go above and beyond what was normal. And that's the point, right? Because otherwise, we're not actually giving proper thanks.
Yeah, oh my goodness, there's so much there. So you're connecting there generosity and thankfulness, which I think is exactly right. So when we are, when we're celebrating, what we are invited to do is we are invited to remember our creatureliness before our God in thanksgiving, but then also we are commanded to be imitators, to be sons of our Father, and to give generously. So, and I think this is perfectly summed up in the fourth commandment, when God instructs His people to not only to rest, but to give rest. So the commandment says, you know, you are to remember the Sabbath, to keep it holy, right? 6 days shall you labor, the seventh is the Lord's, right? On it you will do no work, not you, and not anybody who's in your household. Right, not you, not your sons, not your daughters, not your male servant, female servant. Right, your cow doesn't work on the Lord's day. Right, and that's because we are to be sons of our Father. We are to receive from Him the rest, but then we are also to give rest. That then models for us how we are to celebrate. We are to receive the bounty of God. Right, He made a world where food comes out of the ground, right? Impossibly delicious things just come from light and air and sun and water. We've talked about this, right? And so we just receive that, and we receive it more and more exuberantly than we usually do. But then also we are to give it, and we are to give it lavishly, and we are to give it like He gives it. You're exactly right to identify our fear of indulgence And I think that's particularly true for like our tradition, our Reformed heritage. You know, the Puritans get a bad rap unnecessarily. So don't buy into everything you hear about the Puritans and their, you know, you would have canceled Christmas too, right? If Christmas was now the way it was then, right? You would have been like, yeah, actually, it's more like Mardi Gras. Maybe we should cancel that. So that's not what I mean. But we are afraid of indulgence. And I think that we have to walk a balance between extravagant thankfulness and also generosity. So we should be accused of indulgence, but it not be true, right? That's the line we have to walk, because that's what God has invited us to do. And who's more extravagant than God? Answer, nobody, right?
And that's actually the point that he's, I think, trying to make in Deuteronomy 14, when at the end of that chapter, he commands the people to hold a feast in this way. He says, you've stored up your tithe, and in the place that I tell you, at the end of each year, you're going to eat the tithe. You're going to throw this big party to celebrate what? Wait, what we've tithed, what we've given, what ultimately the Lord has given us, right? We tithe from what he provides for us, and we work for it, obviously, but we don't make the corn and the wheat grow. He does. And he gives abundant harvest or scanty harvest, depending on his good purposes, and oftentimes depending on our faithfulness or our lack thereof. And he's teaching us to take what we've been given and use it to bless others and use it to celebrate his graciousness for giving it. I just love this language. I won't read the whole section of that chapter, but I love this language where he's talking about if you got too far to go on your journey to celebrate the feast and you can't take everything with you because your tithe was that large, it wasn't, you know, a few turtle doves or something, then you should turn it into money. In other words, sell it all, take the money with you. And when you get there, he says this in verse 26, spend the money for whatever you desire, oxen or sheep or wine or strong drink, whatever your appetite craves. I love that language. And you shall eat there before the Lord your God and rejoice, you and your household. And you shall not neglect the Levite who is within your towns, for he has no portion or inheritance with you. And so there you see a number of things that we've already spoken about. You see the idea that this is ultimately to be done before the Lord in thanksgiving. And you also are to be generous, not only you, not only your family, but even the Levites, because they have no portion in the land, right? They don't have the tithe to bring. And so you don't neglect them. You bring them into this celebration of the Lord's providence for you and your family. And you make sure that they have something to celebrate with as well. It's a welcoming time. It's a unifying time. And the crazy thing about this passage to me is he begins up in verses 22 and 23 by saying, the reason you're doing this is so that you may learn to fear the Lord.
No, that's exactly right. And that's something we often miss and is, I think, the chief danger of becoming overly sentimental about Christmas particularly is because the reason that's dangerous is because we easily forget that festivity is always connected to worship. That whatever we gather around, whatever we feast around, is indicative of what we worship. And that's always true for all cultures in all times. It's just usually, in our day and age, we just worship really lame things, right? We worship ourselves, and we worship our own feelings, which is what the sentimentalization of Christmas and other holidays does, right? That's what it's doing. It's saying the thing we're worshiping here is our own feelings. The things we're worshiping here is the, you know, the soft glow, the snow falling, and right, it's me. It's worshiping me. But what Deuteronomy 14 and all the feasts of the Old Testament remind us is that the feast is always before the Lord. The feast is always part of your worship. The feasts were given to Israel as a memorial, as a living, breathing thing in time that is tied to the past, what the Lord has done, and also an act of faith in what the Lord will do. So all the feasts are connected to worship. All the feasts are a memorial. All the feasts shape a society, and they also are shaped by the society. It's always worship.
The memorial aspect there, of the worship, I think, is particularly important, and it ties in nicely with the idea of tradition and why we have traditions, and gives us a way to cut against the kind of sentimentality that you're deriding here, rightly. We don't want to worship the snowfall and the nice, cozy, warm hot chocolate in our laps as we bundle up for the winter. That's not what Christmas is. That's not what Advent is. That's not what we're celebrating, right? We don't even, for Thanksgiving, we're not celebrating the fact that the family is here eating turkey, right? Although that's a little closer to the mark. Thanksgiving is a time to be thankful as a family. And so that's getting a little closer. Yeah. But there's the same kind of cultural ideas that become the source of the celebration. And having good biblical and maybe good biblical traditions and traditions that are grounded in Christian practice throughout church history is something very helpful for us there, because they're not blind to the same things that we're blind to culturally. And so I think there's not a law here specifically in how you celebrate this holiday or that holiday, but it's very wise and prudent, I would say, to go back to church history. And look, that changes at different times in church history. It's not like there's uniformity there, even within one tradition. The Christmas and how that's celebrated changes every 50, 100, 200 years, whatever. And so that's okay. But to go back to a culture that's not contemporary and to say, let me just think about what they did. Let me pull a couple of things here or there from church history. And let's do that as a family, because that will help us to be centered and grounded on what the reason for the particular holiday actually is. And so I just think that's very good. It's good around the idea of Halloween, right? Reclaiming this as a Christian holiday, a Christian celebration, and then All Saints Day, of course, November 1st. It's good around Thanksgiving, thinking about what the first Thanksgiving actually was as an American holiday and that sort of thing. And then obviously Advent, Easter, Christmas, all of these things, mixing them together as a whole. We want to pull some of those traditions because it's a grounding and repetitive element in a good way that always is a reminder. Right, you talk about remembering. It's a reminder of why we set this time aside in a particular way to express gratitude or to celebrate the birth of Christ or to celebrate his death and resurrection, whichever holiday it is.
Yeah, I've linked this idea of festivity to the fourth commandment, but you're exactly right. There's an element that it's linked to the fifth commandment as well, to honor your father and your mother, honor your people, honor where you have come from, to remember. To value what was valued. And that doesn't mean that you celebrate sin, but it does mean that you honor your father because he's your father. You honor your mother because she's your mother. And that's an aspect of gratitude and just being, you know, in the world that God made. He could have had storks actually drop us off, right? But he didn't. He had us connected to other people. And so we live in that, and we submit to that, and we do so for our good and for our joy. Thanksgiving is particularly interesting. And we lump Thanksgiving and Christmas together because they fall near one another in the calendar. And that's another bit that's interesting. Like, God has built rhythm into creation. He's built the seasons, right, that come and go. And there's different things that are fitting at different times. You know, so the harvest festival is particularly fitting because the work's over and we've got all this food, right? And then, you know, the cold winter solstice, you know, time when it's dark and everyone wants to huddle together for warmth and there's not a lot to do, right? Those are wonderful times for big, rich feasts. Whereas, you know, the boisterous days of summer and spring are different, right? So God made it that way. But we lump together Thanksgiving and Christmas because they're near each other in the calendar, but they're very different in origin and they're very different in what they're remembering in a sense. Right, Thanksgiving is an American holiday. It is where we remember our birth, our founding as not like our literal founding as far as, you know, Declaration of Independence and, you know, War of Independence and stuff. Not that, but who were our fathers? Who were our American fathers? What do we value? And then Christmas, of course, is global. It's universal, right? This is a cosmic event in space and time that God takes on our flesh for the redemption of all mankind and the transformation of the world. and we're celebrating and remembering that at Christmas. Two totally different things in terms of scale and scope, but right and good and fitting for us to celebrate them both. I'm interested in your thoughts on differences between Thanksgiving and Christmas. What do they share? How are they distinct in your mind?
I think the obvious one is something you've alluded to, which is that Christmas is particularly the culmination of Advent. It's about the birth of Christ, which is a world-altering event forever. This is, in many ways, you could say, the purpose of creation was that Christ could become a man, live his life, die, be raised from the dead, bring salvation to his people. And so in that sense, like you said, the scale and scope and how exactly that's working, that's a pretty defining and distinct difference, I think. But there are some interesting, I think, similarities. And I'm drawing on my knowledge of the original Thanksgiving, quote unquote, from my fifth grade history class a long time ago. But you do have this similar idea of salvation from death in a coming hard winter. And so it's not the same thing, obviously, and we don't typically think about it that way. But this was a time for these settlers and these Indians to come together and to eat together and celebrate the harvest, like you said, and store up food and help one another and have that kind of spirit of charity and generosity, which are similar things that we often see even culturally being inspired by Christmas. And ultimately, that has a grounding in the meaning of the holiday, which is that what can be more generous than God offering his son to a fallen mankind? And so we imitate him in that, and the culture imitates him in that, even though they don't realize that's what they're doing when they, you know, give that extra donation to the charity or something at the end of the year. Not, you know, some of them maybe just for tax purposes, but even, you know, the non-cynical ones, they'll do it because they really are just moved by the quote-unquote feelings of the season, like we were alluding to earlier. They worship those feelings, but they still do something that in part reflects back on what God has done, which is to be incredibly gracious, incredibly generous with the abundance that they have. And so there's a similarity there to some degree with the Thanksgiving. But yeah, obviously Thanksgiving in particular is different for us because it's an American holiday and specifically bound to not only a more recent time than the birth of Christ by quite a bit, but a particular people. It's not something that's global in that way. And so there's something good and right, I think, about us as Americans getting excited for Thanksgiving. I mean, I hear these stories sometimes about, you know, people who've lived in other countries for a long time or people who moved here from other countries thinking, yeah, we didn't celebrate Thanksgiving. And it shocks me every time I hear it, because why would you not celebrate Thanksgiving? This is like the third biggest holiday of the year, easily. And like for non-Christians, it's the second biggest. It's like Thanksgiving and Christmas. I would put Easter over it in terms of what we're celebrating. Although even with Easter, our festivities aren't typically as big.
Yeah, I don't know. There's something that's really interesting about Thanksgiving. I'm here in North Idaho. You're in Tennessee. And then you'll be in Alabama. And yet we're all going to kind of pretend to be New Englanders for a day. Right, which is on the one hand kind of goofy, but on the other hand, entirely fitting. And I think there's a humility to that that is right, and that we understand better than we think we do when we celebrate, because we're saying, yeah, we're going to remember this with pie and turkey. We're going to remember this with mashed potatoes, even though there were no mashed potatoes at the original Thanksgiving. But I'd love to transition a little bit, but first, kind of one concluding thought on festivity broadly, right? The feast is the token of all the good things in the world. So it's the point for which all of our work and striving are pointing towards. But we're still on pilgrimage, so we can't just have Thanksgiving dinner forever. We have to stop, and we have to put the leftovers in the fridge and get up the next morning and maybe a couple days later, and then go back to work, right? So, but we all know the best things in the world are the feasts. That's what it's all about. And we're not wrong about that. So when you're gathered with your family, with the ones that you love and the ones whom you are bound to, and you participate in this old thing that you're doing now in the present, looking forward to the future, and you're enjoying the good gifts of God, and you're giving lavishly like He does, and you're at peace with one another, this is all the best things in the world. And I argue it all flows from the Lord's Supper. That's where it flows from now. So you have Sabbath rest, right? Sabbath rest is gathered up into Lord's Day worship. Lord's Day worship has at the end of it the participation in the body and blood of our Lord every week, which is, as you alluded to before, the most lavish and generous gift possible. And we participate in it with things of earth, right? With bread and wine, right? And we do so together with one another. So that all, the thing is, that's too big to fit in just that one moment in space and time. And so it spills over and it splashes over. And some of those splashes are called, you know, your Thanksgiving dinner and your Christmas dinner and your hot chocolate around the fire. And like, but it all comes back. It all can be traced back to God's gift of Christ for our sins and the redemption of the world and His invitation to come to His table and have peace with God is the foundation for how we can have peace with one another. So it all goes back to the Lord's Supper.
And even using that phrase, it splashes out or spills over into other areas of life, I think is such a good illustration, because what we're saying is that the Lord's Supper, and to maybe beat the metaphor to death, it gets other things in our lives wet with gratitude.
Yeah.
It teaches us how to be thankful for birthdays. It teaches us how to be thankful for our heritage in America on Thanksgiving and the intense kind of labors that these people went through to provide a life for us. It helps us, obviously, maybe, learn how to appreciate the birth of Christ on Christmas and the anticipation of Christ through Advent and any other holidays that we have. We're learning how to celebrate these good things because we know and are learning constantly how to celebrate the best thing, Lord's Day by Lord's Day, which is the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ and the forgiveness of our sins. And so that literally, I say literally, and I mean figuratively, gets other things wet with gratitude and celebration. And you've got a note in here that I think is so well put, which is that when you think about a people, they are defined by their celebrations, their feast days. You say, we are what we take off work for, which I think is such a good way to say it. And it shows what we value most, which is, this is so important. This is such an essential part of our culture and our livelihood as a nation or a state or a family or whatever it is, that we are going to keep paying people not to come into work. We're going to shut down the society and not fire you when you don't come into work. Most companies say that, right? There are people who have probably been fired on Christmas because they didn't show up, and those companies should be ashamed of themselves. But to have a culture agree, we're not going into work on these days, right? At whatever scale, that could be national, that could be like my cousins. This is something that I always kind of thought was cool. And it's like, man, why don't I get to do that? But also, is that really responsible? And now I appreciate it as an adult. My cousins never had to go to school on their birthdays, which is a great thing, I think, to embody this idea. Like, we value you enough as a person that we're going to take you out of your regular work on this day and give it to you. And we're going to do it as a family. Like, everybody gets out of school on your birthday. It might have, I don't know, it could have just been one of them. But if I was going to do it, I would say everybody gets out of school. We're going to go do something as a family to celebrate this kid. And, you know, obviously, if you have enough kids, you start to run into a problem with attendance in the school. But you cross that bridge when you come to it. You know, surely the schools that we're sending our kids to, they shouldn't have a problem with that sort of thing.
I like it. I like it. Okay. As is our wont, we maybe took longer on the big picture than we ought to have, or maybe we didn't. Who's to say? But I'd love to think, particularly now, more practically. So, and focusing on the dad's role, right? So, what should dad be thinking about when preparing for the holidays? What should dad be thinking about in terms of forming a world. We've talked before about the husband, the man, the father, forming the world so that it can be filled with all sorts of beauty and deliciousness. How should Dad be thinking about that? And the first thing that comes to my mind is generosity, that the father should model the generosity of God. Right? He should be a dim reflection of the generosity of God to his people. And just as God causes, you know, the rain to fall on the just and the unjust, just as he, you know, just lavishes us with grace and with goodness, Dad should be like that. So thoughts on that, or how do you see that fleshing out?
I think that's right. I think it's something, again, that is essential to understand with any holiday that you're celebrating. If you're taking time to celebrate it, you're saying this is worth celebrating. So make it a celebration. Make it generous towards your wife and your children and others, you know, extended family or friends or whatever. Invite them into it. Welcome them into it. We've had, I remember being in college or as a young married couple, even before we had kids, but even after we had kids, actually, you know, we're disconnected from family at times. So we're not necessarily traveling for Easter, but we've had families from church say, hey, we're having Easter lunch after church. Come be with us, be part of our family for this day, whether that's as, single college students or, you know, early on in our marriage. So having that kind of attitude where you're willing to bring people into your home, into your family in this time. And there are times, obviously, to make it just you and the kids and your wife, and that's important and you should protect it. But there are also times and occasions or periods of even a celebration like Christmas where, you know, you might do your family thing and then you have a time where friends do come over, whether it's that day or the day before or after, whatever. And there's a lot of freedom there. But I think showing your children what generosity looks like in a particular way, like what is the point of our generosity? It's to do all the things that we've been talking about. Why do we eat a special meal? Why do we spend more money on this meal than on other meals? Why do we spend money on these gifts rather than just having a normal day, saying a prayer, reading some scripture, reflecting on God's mercies? Well, it's because of what this sort of celebration does to us and how it shapes us as people. This kind of generosity teaches us to fear the Lord. It teaches us that he's in control. He is worthy of our worship. He is going to sustain us. He's going to protect us and provide for us. And yeah, all of that is baked. It's almost too big to put into words. Maybe it is too big to put into words, which is why you put it into a feast. And you put it into a feast every year, right?
That's right. That's right. And feasts cost money. And feasts take time to prepare. And so I think it's so important, and this is something I've been preaching to myself every year. I feel like I'm doing better and better, but still have a long way to go. That we have to give our money to this, right? If we're, like you said, if we really think that it's important, we have to treat it as important. So we have to give our money to it. So, you know, there should be a line item in your budget, which is feast, festivity, Christmas, Thanksgiving. And you should contribute to that, you know, save up over time, probably more than you think is reasonable. If you're like me, I've had to, every year I feel like I set aside money and I set aside too little. This is, in order for it to be a fitting celebration, it should be, it should be costly, like we talked about with dates. Dates ought to be costly if your marriage is really something that ought to be celebrated.
A couple of notes there. First, it makes me think of what I've heard Doug say in a book or maybe a podcast or something, which is early on in his marriage, he remembers, you know, the kids are there for Christmas and they were like shoestring budget, rice and beans, like the works, working on making sure they could pay rent or their mortgage or whatever every month. And it was that dire. And so he went down to the dollar store and got like a bag of bungee cords and a handful of other little things like that for a few bucks. And the point that you're making is not spend irresponsibly. The point is spend sacrificially. Like that was a legitimate sacrifice for them at that time. Again, ask other couples who early on in marriage have struggled with money just because things were tight, not because they were irresponsible. Maybe don't ask the ones who are irresponsible and that's why they were struggling. Ask the ones who you know did a good job and still had a hard time anyway.
Yeah.
what are some creative things that I can do when I've got $15? And that's like, I don't have other money to use, and I'm not gonna spend it on a credit card and take out a line of credit to get these presents. I'm gonna spend what I have, but I'm gonna spend all that I have here. This is the extra $15 I have. You know, that's well and good. Ask people for thoughts. And also, maybe hand in hand with this, so this is now a third point that I want to kind of add in the middle of the 2 points. Think about things that are creative that don't cost money, but that do take time.
Yep.
So I've recently, I've sent you some pictures and thought about some things. I've recently taken to trying to make presents out of wood, you know, doing some very rudimentary, like a bow and a sword and things like that with, you know, the woodworking stuff that I have. That doesn't cost anything if I already have the scrap wood, and you can make a really cool toy out of a piece of scrap wood if you've got a handful of tools. And you don't need to be able to sell it on Amazon for $60, right? It doesn't have to be that kind of quality. Do your best, take your time, but it doesn't have to be a kind of professional grade. The kid's going to be thrilled to get it and thrilled that you made it, right? Those two things go hand in hand to make it all the richer. And then lastly, this is something, you know, we just had a members meeting at church, and we were talking about the new church budget. This is where the pastors kind of present the budget and let us know, like, okay, where do we want to increase budget? What are we taking money away from? How are we shifting things around? And those, oddly enough, are very entertaining. Tom still does them from the time that you're here. You'll remember that.
Oh,
but he's gotten
great.
More
that's
and
great.
More like
oh,
a
man.
Comedian over the years during that time, and it's really fun.
I bet he has.
Last night, I mean, more than a handful of times where the whole congregation is just cutting up with laughter because he's just inserting one liner after one liner, you know, about how the budget is. And it's amazing to me that he can make that many funny comments about a budget. But I digress. The point that he made that he continues to make again and again, which is so important, is as Christians, our first responsibility in our finances is to give to the Lord, is to be generous towards the church, the people of God. I would maybe footnote that with, if that's true, then it follows that our second primary responsibility in our giving and our generosity is to be a blessing to our households, right? To bless our children. And then obviously that extends in larger and larger circles, friends, extended family, that sort of thing. But you give to the church, you budget for that. If you don't, you should. And even give above and beyond your budget oftentimes. And then you give to your family. And I think you're right to say we should put this in a budget. We should have a plan for this money and how we're getting it, where it's coming from. And to spend a little lavishly, like more than you think you should. If you're comfortable with it, maybe increase it by like 5%, 10%, something like that. Yep. And if you're still comfortable with it, push it another 5 or 10%. And when you start to feel a little uncomfortable, like, I don't know, like, okay, that might be a good place.
Yeah. Yeah. For me personally, every time Christmas comes and goes, I look back and think, oh man, I was too stingy. Like I was not like my God in how I treated my household. All right. Do better next time. But your point is well taken and is exactly right. There are times when you don't have the money or there are times when giving lavishly is, $25, right? And your point about making gifts is, I think, wonderful, but be lavish in that, right? Be lavish with whatever you have. Lavish with your time. Lavish with your attention, even. This is give what you have. And your point about making, first of all, you use the word rudimentary with your woodworking projects. Based on the pictures I've seen, rudimentary is not quite the word I would use. You're selling yourself short. But if you were to, the funny thing about making stuff is there's almost, unless you're really, really, really good, there's very little, it's very, very unlikely that you'll be able to sell it for what it's worth, right? You're like, I spent 10 hours on that. My time's worth how much? Oh, huh, shoot. But you can flip that and think, yeah, I spent 10 hours on that. You know, at my hourly rate, like this gift that I'm about to give my little boy is, you know, worth some serious change, right? There's no way anyone could pay for this, right? And so actually I am able to give generously, to give him something that money could not buy, right? What Kels quotes a line she got from somebody, like, there's that's a $400 pair of socks right there, considering the yarn and the time it took, right? And even as a basic hourly rate, like, there's no way anybody would buy you a $400 pair of socks, but I just gave it to you. The only way to have it is to have someone who's willing to lavish their time and attention that way. So I think dad should be thinking, I need to be like my God. I need to be generous, giving with whatever it is that I have. But another element that dad needs to be keenly aware of, I think, is that he is unable to do this thing called putting on a feast by himself. Very obviously and hilariously, he is unable because dad can't cook, at least in my experience. And so in order for the feast to happen, there has to be Herculean outputs on the part of the missus. And so dad needs to be aware of that. And we can be so naive and just assume that food just appears magically out of the kitchen. At least I can. Clear communication with your wife is critical in putting on a feast or participating in a feast. And so that looks like, you know, weeks in advance, if possible, saying, all right, you know, darling, this is what I'm imagining. And then when she's done laughing, then, you know, you can say, okay, what are you imagining, right? And you come to understand, like, okay, what can we do? What ought we to do? And then she communicates to you, like, what will be required to make that vision a reality?
I think this goes back to what you mentioned just a couple of episodes ago, maybe, which is that amateurs think about strategy, professionals think about logistics, right? If you want a feast day to go well, whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas or Easter or whatever, a birthday, you need to be planning logistically with your wife. And I think this is something that I haven't considered as much for bigger holidays. I consider it for birthdays because we're the ones leading that. And so Megan and I talk about the holiday meal and what we're going to provide and who we're inviting and how many people do we need to feed, that sort of thing. But when we do Thanksgiving and Christmas, we're doing those with extended family and we're going out of town. So we might do something like we have the kids home for Christmas morning and we'll do a breakfast or something like that. But that's relatively low key. It's not like the big Christmas meal that we celebrate. And when we go to family, it's incredible to watch because it does feel like food just magically appears because I've got three older sisters and now there's Megan and there's my mom and any family friends in the mix. And it's just all of these ladies for a week straight cooking and preparing oftentimes and getting things ready. And my mom is not only an excellent cook, she loves to cook and loves to cook for people and to bring them delight through food. And so oftentimes it'll work out where we're there for a few days and we're building up to Christmas dinner by getting these other incredible dinners night after night. And we don't all, you know, sit around the table in the same way and celebrate in the same way, but it's like, okay, here's enchilada bake. And it's this really, really delicious meal that you're not just scrounging for leftovers or you're not going out to eat or whatever. And now the next night, here's this, you know, tomato tortellini soup or whatever it is. And it's just like five rock star meals in a row. And then the culmination is the Christmas meal. So all of that to say, I have learned to appreciate how much goes into it just by watching them because there are constant grocery runs. There are constant like back and forth to the store to get these things that we need for the next meal or whatever. And I've also learned from even the time that I was still at home and could drive, part of my job, because I'm not cooking and involved in most of that, I like to make an apple pie and I'll do that with my mom because she taught me how and it's a sweet thing to still do. But other than that, I'm kind of hands out of the kitchen, right? I'm not there unless it's to go by and test things. But I would go out and, you know, as a high schooler, I would drive to the store all the time and just be back and forth regularly. And my friend would even do it because he would come over for Christmas and, you know, when he was done at his house. And so he would be sent to the store at times to go and get things. And he would love to do it because he's like, I get free food out of this. So look for ways that you can assist in those sorts of things. That could look like on a smaller scale, if it's just you and your family, you know, what do you need me to do in terms of keeping the kids? You know, what can I do with them?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want help from the kids? Do you want any of them to be involved? I can take the others and we can do this other thing while you're working on breakfast or lunch or dinner, whatever it is. And look for practical ways like that to ease her burden and take things off her plate so that she can really focus on not just executing. You know, you've said, I think we should do, you know, whatever, chicken and waffles for breakfast. And that's our tradition for Christmas or whatever. Not just that, but to really make it special and lavish in her own way, which she's going to, as you've mentioned, she's going to run circles around you in that regard and make it really, really wonderful. Give her the kind of headspace to do that.
That's exactly right. And often that can just mean, let me take the kids. And especially if you have, you know, a wife who loves to cook. That can be, I don't know, that can be a treat for her in and of itself, just to be able to prepare food without also thinking about where are the kids and what are they doing. And speaking of which, this is tangentially related, but the importance of food and the importance of blessing your family with good food is, it is easy to underestimate how important that is. But that's the thing that binds a family together more than almost anything else. And that's the thing that will keep your children as they grow coming back to you, right? And it's strange, but that's actually sometimes what keeps children in the faith. Like as they go out and they encounter godless ideologies and you know, false prophets, they hear that and you're like, they're nodding as their, you know, philosophy 101 prof is prattling on. Like, yeah, you know, you're sound, you make some points, but you have yet to refute the cheesy potato casserole. And I'm just not sure you're gonna, right? So that actually is a hugely important apologetic for the faith, which ties back to what we've been talking about before. The feast flows from the goodness of God, and your table ought to reflect that. And that means you set up your wife for success in giving her the time, the money, the space, the literal space, and the metaphorical space to bless your household in that way.
One thing on that to just emphasize, and if you want to expound any, you can, but you say, right, that the cheesy potato casserole is an apologetic for the philosophy 101 professor. And I had not considered that maybe in those terms before, but I think you're right. And you're getting at something that's really, really true. And it could be an easy thing to pass over and think, oh, that's just like a passing joke in the middle of some podcast somewhere, but it's really not, because what you look at when you see a household, a family who is unified in mind and purpose and delighting in the celebration of the good gifts of God, like that's what the cheesy potato casserole means. That's what it is. And when your philosophy 101 professor is chastising you because he doesn't see the big deal about Christmas and is glad it's becoming more and more pagan by the hour, right? He's saying that because I would say 99 times out of 100, if not more, there was no warmth and deep abiding joy around his Christmas table, right? That's coming out of a wound in some way, almost certainly, that there's this thing that people have, this joy, this peace, this fellowship with God that people have that I don't, and I'm bitter about it. And so I attack it. And so the reverse is also true. If that can, for some, be a cause for rejecting God and for being angry at God because they see what they don't have, then let it be for your family a defense for God, right? Why do I believe God exists? Because we would come together and sing and laugh and chortle with joy as we ate, you know, grandma's potato casserole or my dad's famous smoked turkey or whatever it was. And we did that every year.
That's right. I'm reminded of Philippians chapter 1, where he says, then whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in one spirit, striving together as one for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign to them that they will be destroyed, but that you will be saved, and that by God. So the unification, the peace, the harmony of the Christian is actually like a war cry. It's a polemic. It's a trumpet against, you know, Satan and his minions, against the bad guys. So when you are gathered around your table in harmony and in fellowship with one another because you're in fellowship with your God, this is not a retreat. This is actually a bold stand. This is an advance against the gates of hell.
In that way, what you're saying makes me think of, maybe you would call it some woo-woo Presbyterianism again, which is that, what is the feast doing? Like, why meals again, coming back to that point? Why do we do this around a shared dinner table? And what are we doing? Well, we're proclaiming Christ's victory over death. And not just in the meaning behind the meal, not just in the reason for the occasion, but in the meal itself. We are at peace with one another, joyfully celebrating as we eat food, which will sustain our very lives. And that sustenance, the reason that God ties it, at least I think part of the reason that God ties it to sustenance, is to show we are celebrating that God is keeping us alive, and he's keeping us alive lavishly. He's keeping us alive and in a place of joy and celebration, and not in a place of drudgery and not in a place of fear. This is, I think, very closely tied to the way that we mourn as Christians, which we're gripped by death and sorrow in a deep way, and in some ways, maybe at times deeper than unbelievers, because we recognize the affront to God that death is, that some of them, you know, just have to accept because they don't know what's coming or why it exists or whatever. You know, they don't have answers, so they just kind of accept death for what it is. But no, we can say death isn't natural, so we mourn it as something that's unnatural, that's this grievous kind of affront to reality, to God, you know, God himself and the creation order. And yet we also grieve as those with hope. And so we can say, again, to the person who's been offended by God and is angry at God because so-and-so died who I loved, and how could God, if he exists, ever take this person from me? And they're bitter, and they're just kind of enthralled in that cycle of death. When they attack God with the problem of evil, we can say, yeah, but I'm a Christian. And that means death doesn't really touch me in that way. It has no sting, right? It rolls off my back. And one day, I'll be taken in death, and that is okay because I will not stay there. I'll be raised. You know, there's this deep sense of security that Christians have. That I love the way you put it. It's a battle cry, right? The security of the Father's love is our battle cry to the unbelieving world. That hopefully, and many times, and in many ways, will draw them to submit to the Lord and draw them to faith.
Wrapping this up, so much of what we're talking about is just simply telling the truth about the world. And you pointed out that the meal itself is not a symbol. It's not something that reminds us of the real thing. It's part of the real thing in and of itself. You can't be a Gnostic because Christ came in the flesh. You have to enjoy the good things of God because they're good. How do we know they're good? Well, they're good because Christ came in the flesh. He was here to redeem the whole world, right? It's, you know, God so loved the world, all of it, that he gave his son for the redemption of all things. So when we celebrate, we're just telling the truth about how the world is. And when you as a dad are giving generously, you're telling the truth about who God is and how the world that he made operates. So maybe final thoughts from me. You, like we talked about at the beginning, you should be potentially accused of indulgence, but it should not be true. And how do you guard against indulgence? You guard against indulgence by thanksgiving, by radical thanksgiving for every bit of it, and recognizing therein that this is not about the stuff only, but it is about your God and about the relationship you have to your God, and that is real and tangible. But then also, Dad, you should be dying to yourself throughout the whole thing as well, right? And you're going to be giving generously. And your kids might never know how generously you gave. They shouldn't. They shouldn't know what the budget was. They should just be delighting in the gifts, the way that we are with our God, right? We don't know what the budget was. Well, we do, actually. But we can't fathom it. Right? We kind of smile and nod like, yeah, Jesus, he died. But we don't have any conception of it, truly. And yet God gives to us. And so the holiday season is not a time for me. It's not a time for me to camp out on the couch with my remote control. It's a time for me to be faithfully, diligently, joyously, jovially showering blessing on everyone around me.
Yeah, that would be my last word as well, is just a kind of brief exhortation against that sort of thinking of, you know, just me on the couch relaxing, not doing anything, which I need for myself to really come to grips with this reality that the holiday time is not about me and yeah. My leisure and my pleasure. Those things will come, but they should only come because I am working to sacrifice for the good of the covenant family, or the, you know, again, friends, extended family, that sort of thing. And I'm making sacrifices. I love the way you put it, you know, make unseen sacrifices, don't let them know the budget, that sort of thing. You know, when I was making the bunk bed for the boys last Christmas and I finished it, you know, just in time, I spent many, many nights alone out in the shop after they went to bed. Megan's not out there. We're not spending all of that time together that I had off of Christmas break. I mean, we got plenty of time. I'm not complaining about that. But this time that we would normally just spend together and we could have spent together, well, I had a bunk bed to build. And so I was out there regularly. And, you know, she had gone to bed many times by the time that I got back in from the shop. And they didn't see that. They don't know that it took that long or that much of my time, but it did. And that's a good thing. I don't begrudge even a second of that, because the purpose behind it was to bless them and to make that sacrifice so that they could enjoy the good thing. And so I think it's just a temptation for me, and probably for most dads, to think that, yeah, the holidays are a time to kind of kick my feet up, relax. I'm home from work. That means I don't need to do much. I don't need to be responsible for things. All of this will just fall into place and happen around me. But that's just not true. That's treating the holiday like a child treats the holiday, which is fitting for a child and not fitting for us as fathers, right? We have to be doing the things that our parents always did that we never saw to make this happen. And if we're not, right, then it's not going to be blessing our children in the way that we hope it will. In fact, it's going to be causing probably frustration or consternation for them and for our wives. And, you know, I think our wives often get this, and we've got to not only come alongside them, but we have to lead them in that and show that we're the ones taking the initiative. We're the ones giving the direction and working to the bitter end to pull these things off. And sometimes our ideas are a little ambitious and we get out over our skis. And we've committed to it, and especially if you told the kids about it beforehand like a fool, then you got to stay up till 3 a.m. by golly and get it done. But that's okay. Yeah. There's grace for that, and you can learn from your mistakes next time. But on a, you know, not to make too light of it, that's a good thing, right? Staying up till 3 a.m. to make something happen that you told your kids is going to happen, and it was just way more than you thought it would be. That's a beautiful and godly thing to do.
Amen. Well, wrapping up, what's your book recommendation for us today, sir?
Yeah, so this week I am recommending The Aeneid by Virgil. So The Aeneid is an epic poem. It's debated. I don't know. You can ask an expert if you want. One of the greatest epic poems ever written in the Western world. Certainly top two or three. And it kind of has gone back and forth between that and the Iliad or the Odyssey for the most part. So Virgil writes, in the Roman world, this is roughly 800 years or so after Homer records the Iliad and the Odyssey. And, you know, those are oral stories that are passed down in the proto-Greek world, and Homer just writes them down. And I'm sure, you know, brings together the oral tradition in a certain kind of way and has his own sort of things that he's focusing on. Virgil, it's funny, when I read these with my students all back to back to back, they said, Virgil's just a plagiarist. He's just copying Homer, which is true, but he's not plagiarizing. he is copying in some sense, because he recognizes the deep value and transcendence of Homer's works. And he's seeking to tell essentially the Roman version of those stories, and he kind of pulls the greatest hits from the Iliad and the Odyssey and puts them together in one story and presents one of the most central works of literature and of storytelling in the Western world. So if you haven't read the Aeneid, it's not like you're missing so-and-so's footnotes on this treatise on human nature in this era of the world. You're missing one of the most central texts of the Western world, and you really should read it. It's profound, it's staggering, eminently applicable for Christians. There are so many biblically adjacent metaphors or images that are happening. There's a lot with death and resurrection. There's a lot with destiny. There's a lot with the justice of a king being executed against his enemies and those sorts of things. So the Aeneid by Virgil, excellent poetry. I would recommend the translation by Fitzgerald. I haven't read much from others, but it's one of the more heralded translations. It maintains some of the cadence and the rhythm. One that I would not recommend, just for linguistic reasons, and it's a harder read, I think, for English speakers, is Fagel's. So he keeps the tense of the Latin verbs the same as in Latin. And the problem with that is that the storytelling tense in Latin is the present tense. And so it can be confusing if you have a character in the story telling a story about what happened, you know, 3 months ago, but it's all in present tense. And you think, wait, are these things happening now? Or is this still the story? And it gets confusing for English speakers because we use the past tense to tell stories typically. And so Fagel's does a good job in that regard. He's not a slouch by any means, but it is, I think, harder to understand oftentimes.
Solid stuff, solid stuff. My recommendation this week is actually directly tied to kind of some of the themes we talked about today, and that is Leisure, the Basis of Culture by Joseph Pieper. Nice short read, and it makes, I don't know, it's kind of the where I got a number of the thoughts that have been we've been kicking around today. So, yeah, great stuff, making the point that we don't rest for our work, but we work towards our rest, and that what we celebrate defines the who we are as a people. So a lot of the stuff we already talked about, but if you want it straight from the horse's mouth in much more eloquent prose, Joseph Pieper.
All right. Great. Thanks for joining us for the show. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you want to follow what we're writing about or neglecting to write about to this very day, then you can see a link to our Substack in the description below. You can also see a link to our Patreon page where you can support the show. We'd love to have your support to make sure that we can continue to produce the show. There are some financial costs, so if you can contribute in that way and if the show has been helpful for you, we'd love to see your support. And then we want to say thank you to Shane Caver for providing our theme music, and thank you to ETC Media for helping us out and editing the show. They've been great to us and a pleasure to work with. So with that, we hope you've been blessed and edified by the show.
Don't be hasty.
Anyway, now that I've gotten you really out of your headspace for the episode.
Oh, no, this is where I live, out of my headspace.
It's where we both live.